You're listening to RSJ Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Newsnight from Ryerson University. I'm Nikhil Sharma.
And I'm Natasha Herman. Here are your headlines for Tuesday, November the 1st. Finance Minister Bill Morneau has announced a budget this afternoon, estimating big deficits over the next 5 years and on to finance a new tax-free monthly child benefit, more money for First Nations, infrastructure spending, and extended insurance benefits to hard-hit regions. The debt is expected to grow by $113 billion by 2010, and the deficit is $29.4 billion this year.
I'm happy to announce that the Government of Canada is establishing a new Canada Investment Bank, infrastructure bank rather, through which at least $35 billion will flow to help us undertake transformative projects that might not otherwise get built.
By 2017, expect children's arts and fitness tax credit to be phased out, while teachers receive a credit for teaching materials. Also, Indigenous peoples will receive $8.4 billion over the next 5 years, $2.6 billion exclusively for secondary education on reserves, $120 billion over 10 years will be put towards infrastructure, and $1.9 billion will be spent on arts and culture organizations.
Big changes today for university students who are on OSAP. The federal government is changing when students have to repay their loans. Students won't have to pay back their OSAP until they are earning money, at least $25,000 a year. Serena Kwok has a story.
Sarah Hamoud is a second-year journalism student. She is relying on OSAP to help her pay for her tuition. She thinks the change is less stressful for students.
The way they set it up before, you had to start paying back 6 months after you left school. I think it put a lot of pressure on people to find a job from the get-go once you got out of university. And I think this will leave a little more room for people to explore their options after university, figure out what their next path is.
Daniel Liz is the Student Action Commissioner for the Ryerson Students Union. He explains that the OSAP lobbying done by groups like the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations have led to the federal government changing their rules.
There's been a lot of lobbying from a bunch of different groups, especially CASA. CASA's been working really hard towards, working with the government, certain proposals, lobbying for many years towards any sort of benefit for the student in regards to tuition. And so I think that this is a long time coming, honestly. Personally, I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to be able to like work on my career and not have to worry about repaying my student debts until I've been able to get $25,000. So I think that there's been a lot of lobbying from different groups, especially CASA, and I'm happy that this happened. In general, I think there's a incline on the amount of students that are applying for OSAP, but I think this will definitely make the commitment towards OSAP a lot easier to make because you're not going to have to worry about the repayment right afterwards as much.
Students on campus today say they think the change will help them when they graduate.
Yeah, it does help a lot, like especially if you come out of school and then you're trying to find a job, you don't have that, you're not guaranteed like the field of your choice, so you have to work somewhere else, like retail for example, until you get your job. So it's a lot better to like get started first.
Like a lot of people who suffer from OSAP, like giving money back, they think it's pretty hard to pay back the interest and the money. I think this will help a lot of people.
Earning $25,000 a year is just over a minimum wage salary. This does help students, but it is going to cost the government a lot of money, about $1.53 billion. Serena Kwok, reporting for Newslight.
Former Liberal organizer Jax Carveau has been convicted on 3 fraud-related charges in connection with the federal program. The guilty verdict came down after 5 days of jury deliberations. Carveau, 83, was charged with fraud against the government, producing fake documents, and laundering proceeds of crime. The series crime took place between 1997 and 2003. The investigation revealed that Carveau received 6 million checks for services that were never fulfilled.
Ontario's Liberal Party CEO will step down aside after being charged under the Elections Act, Premier Kathleen announced today. The Toronto Star reported that the Ontario Provincial Police will lay bribery charges against Deputy Chief Pat Sobera and Liberal operative Gary Lougheed, related to a 2015 Sudbury by-election. If found guilty under the bribery section of the Election Act, the penalty is a fine up to $25,000 or 2 years in jail.
A traveling art show made a stop at Ryerson today as part of Social Justice Week. The repurposed shipping container on Gold Street holds an exhibit dealing with sexual assault on campus. Lamise Wajat reports.
The heart of Ryerson's campus is often crowded with protests. Some students, like first-year Alexandra Halibar, find a few of them disturbing, but a new art project is turning that space into something more positive.
We always see like the anti-abortion protesters here, and it was nice to see this kind of as a change.
Hannah Shafi is the artist behind an empowering pop-up on Gould Street.
First Kid is my art name.
Shafi is a former Ryerson student. She says her art tackles issues around feminism and surviving sexual assault.
Sexual violence is a problem in post-secondary institutions, so this is sort of a good environment to raise awareness about sexual violence and to start dialogue because it's very especially relevant here.
First-year student Emma Johnston said she appreciates how inclusive the exhibit is.
It's not so graphic that like a guy wouldn't want to walk in because it's just kind of cool in general and it makes you want to read them.
Ryerson launched its Sexual Violence Support Office just last year. The exhibit is one of its contributions to Social Justice Week. Student Vicky Wang said these initiatives are important, both for those who want to talk and those who need to listen.
They can talk back and have their own lost words be found.
You can catch First Kid's work on campus until Friday. For Newsnight, I'm Lamise Wajahid.
Convicted serial killer Paul Bernardo's date parole hearing is scheduled for next March. Tim Dawson, lawyer for the families of the murdered victims, says that many dates have been scheduled in the past for date parole hearings, but all have been delayed. Bernardo was convicted in 1995 and sentenced to life with no chance of parole for 25 years for raping and murdering Maffey and French. If granted, date parole would allow Bernardo to leave jail, take part in community activities, and return to prison at night.
You're listening to Dean Blundell and Company on Toronto Sports Radio, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
A sexual assault case from 2013 had its verdict overturned due to a juror's homophobic comments made on the Dean Blundell show. The show was canceled after host Blundell and producer Derek Wellsman, who was a juror, discussed the trial on air. The court argued that Wellsman's homophobic bias and clear unwillingness to adhere to the court process had a significant effect on the jury. Meanwhile, the man was served 2 years of his sentence and Blundell had a show on Fan 590.
It's 2016, but there is still a sizable wage gap. It's no surprise that many professions are affected by this, but at Ryerson today, we heard about how it affects women in academia as well. Ryan Tucho has a story.
In the Student Campus Center this afternoon, women from all walks of life got together to talk about an issue that affects everyone, the gender wage gap, and the subsequent need for better equality. It's not just low-income women, it can affect professional women too. Lori Petro is an associate professor at Ryerson who spoke at a panel on pay equity today.
Here at Ryerson University, many of our students are continually surprised to learn that many of their female professors are paid less than their male counterparts, almost across the board in all of our disciplines.
Contract lecturer Kelly Train spoke about how this affects contract lecturers in an astounding way.
Contract lecturers are the poorest paid. We're the most precarious workers in the university. We face constant job insecurity. So as I just said, we have to actually apply for jobs every 4 months.
Keynote speaker Charlotte Yates gives one important change necessary for there to be positive improvement. It will take organization and people willing to step up in order to make a change.
Grouping, they need to play a leadership and supportive leadership in all kinds of institutions. And yet, women are underrepresented in leadership roles.
15 and Fairness is planning an action for December 3rd. Panelists say people must step up and get organized because no one will make changes for them. For Newsnight, I'm Ryan Tucho.
A strike started today at the University of Manitoba after the university's proposal for key issues about workload and job security was rejected. More than 1,200 faculty members from Fort Garry and Benanti campuses set up pickup lines at 7 a.m. this morning. The university and faculty say that the province suggested to freeze pay for all public sector workers. Premier Brian Paslier refused to confirm the statement, but he did say that the increase of wages is not sustainable and that the finances of the province need to be fixed.
With just 7 days to election night, controversy continues to follow both Clinton and Trump on the campaign trails. Matt Ama has been on the story. Matt, what's the latest?
The Clinton campaign Monday called an FBI investigation a jaw-dropping double standard, following early reports that FBI Director James Comey withheld evidence of Russian tampering with the election. In the report, it's alleged Comey cited a fear of releasing information too closely to the election night, claiming to not want to in any way influence the outcome of the election.
Does the Clinton campaign believe Russia had any role in this?
Well, people are looking into what they call questionable dealings between the Trump campaign and Russian officials, as well as a tie to the series of leaks and hacks we've been seeing as of recently on Democratic Party organizations, WikiLeaks, so on and so forth. News of Comey also comes just as the FBI renews interest in Clinton's emails, this time zeroing in on Vice Chairwoman of the Clinton campaign, Huma Abedin. Just 11 days before the election, the FBI obtains a search warrant to review the roughly 650,000 emails found on the laptop of Abedin's estranged husband, Anthony Weiner. It's a revelation that Trump has since called the motherlode, predicting Clinton's 33,000 emails could be found in the process.
She gets a subpoena, and she deletes and bleaches, and nobody even ever heard of bleaching. Did anybody ever hear of bleaching? You know why it's such an expensive process? But it makes them go away. But I have a feeling they've just found a lot of them, don't you think? Have a feeling. Uma. They just found a lot of them. We never thought we were going to say thank you to Anthony Weiner.
What is the Clinton's campaign's response to the new revelations?
Well, the campaign remains confident, saying today they insist they cannot be thrown off course, with Clinton saying, "I think most people decided a long time ago what they think of all of this." The Trump campaign today is in Wisconsin, while Clinton remains in Florida.
Is any of this impacting the polls?
The Clinton campaign denies any anecdotal evidence of any impact from any of the FBI stories. But in CNN's poll of polls, Clinton is up 5 points nationwide, while ABC News and The Washington Post cite a near tie with just days remaining in the election. So with the two-year cycle nearly concluded, we'll have to wait until Election Day to see how this plays out come November 8th. Stay tuned.
Thanks for the update, Matt.
At least 19 were killed today in Pakistan and India in a cross-border shelling attack from both sides between the countries in the disputed region of Kashmir. Tension in the region had increased since September, after a cross-border raid on an army base killed 19 Indian soldiers, resulting in strikes against Islamic militants in Pakistan. Each side accuses the other of violating a 2003 ceasefire. However, both sides also disagree with each other's version of the events in the India-ruled Kashmir after security forces killed a nationalist field commander in July. The clashes come at a time of heightened tension between the neighbors over Kashmir. A Muslim-majority region has been disputed territory between India and Pakistan for the past 70 years.
There has been over 1,000 aftershocks since a 6.6 magnitude quake shook central Italy on Sunday. This has been the most intense earthquake in Italy in 36 years. The earthquake struck north of Norcia, and as of today, 6 people have been pulled from the rubble. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi spoke Sunday in Norcia about rebuilding the destruction caused by the earthquake.
Ma soprattutto diamo un messaggio alle popolazioni. Noi ricostruiremo tutto.
We will rebuild everything, the houses, the churches, and the businesses. We are speaking about a marvelous area. We are speaking about an area in which has beauty and such a welcome that is really part of their identity.
The tremors have been happening occasionally since the earthquake from this past August, which killed almost 300 people in Italy. Although the earthquake was located in central Italy, some tremors were felt north near the Alps and south of Rome. Many residents are placed in temporary shelters. 20 are injured, but fortunately, no one has died. Historical buildings like the Balsia of San Benedetto of Norcia have been destroyed, and some towns are almost fully evacuated.
Turkish police detained the editor-in-chief and several writers of a Turkish opposition non-religious newspaper on Monday. The newspaper's cartoonist, Musa Kart, said he will surrender to the police.
This is ridiculous. You will not intimidate anyone by putting pressure. I want to say that. It is impossible for people with conscience to endorse this scene. You cannot justify this to the world. Today I'm being detained for drawing cartoons and only for drawing cartoons. Some of our friends are detained. Six or seven friends are under custody for the moment, and I am now going there to surrender. I will go there to surrender. There is no reason to hide or to run away. Everything I write and draw are out there. I will go there and come back.
The opposition newspaper's previous editor was sentenced to 6 years for publishing state secrets involving Syria operations. The arrest came after a day after Turkish government dismissed 10,000 servants and closed 15 other media outlets over suspected links with militant groups.
And now we'll go live to Sel Faruqi in the studio to hear the latest on a Montreal journalist that was spied on by police.
That's right, Nikhil. The news broke out yesterday that Montreal's police service had been spying on La Presse's Patrick Laglace, one of Quebec's most well-known journalists, for months. They'd been doing it to get a hold of confidential sources that he'd been speaking to in an attempt to find out their identities. Now, there hasn't only been an outcry at this nationally, there's been one internationally. Even Edward Snowden, the man behind the NSA leaks on the U.S. government spying, tweeted about it, saying, "Are you a journalist? The police spying on you specifically to ID your sources isn't a hypothetical. This is today." I spoke to Lisa Taylor, a Ryerson journalism prof that specialized in law and journalism, and she says the most worrying thing about all this is that it was actually legal. She called that ability to legally hinder the freedom of the press appalling, and said it sets an example that could easily be followed by other police departments in Canada. Whether it'll keep happening in the future, we'll have to see, but for the meantime, we'll have to watch our backs. Back to you, Nikhil.
Thanks for the update, Sel.
In Ottawa, Sergeant Chris Heschnier pled guilty to multiple charges related to the racist comments he made online. He made the comments after Inuk artist Annie Pudgoot was found dead in September. Heschnier's two charges related to knowingly using racist language and to commenting on an open investigation. Heschnier was responsible for processing the scene and identifying Pudgoot at the time of his comments. After the hearing, Heschnier apologized for his actions.
Ryerson University is looking to cut down on prejudice and discrimination, and they are starting in the classroom. As Caleb Collin reports, teaching assistants attended a workshop today.
Have you ever experienced discrimination in the classroom? Have you ever wished that your professor or TA was more sensitive to stereotypes and prejudice? Ryerson is trying to change that. Today it held a workshop on assessing cultural competencies. It helped TAs to address differences such as sexual identity and orientation, racial identity, physical disabilities, and religious views. Daryl Bowsden facilitated the talk. He ran interactive exercises to allow TAs to express their opinions on cultural issues relevant to school. Rebecca Calderwood, a Ryerson journalism grad, was among the TAs in the workshop.
So we went through some exercises that individually and then as a group that got us thinking about what our own biases are and how we project that onto a classroom.
As Ryerson strives toward helping students feel comfortable, starting in the classroom is a good place. For Newsnight, I'm Kayla McLaughlin.
Between grabbing someone's attention and clawing at them, both the Sick Kids Foundation and the TTC recently released ad campaigns that provoked a strong backlash. Let's go live to Madonna Dennis to learn more.
Thanks, Nicole. Last Tuesday, the Sick Kids Foundation released an ad campaign comparing kids battling illnesses to battling war. But parents say this creates an unrealistic expectation for kids living with diseases and disabilities. Some kids can't be warriors against enemies like permanent disabilities. Sick Kids says that the ad isn't meant to say all kids should be fighters, but that they're fighting for all kids. But the foundation isn't the only one accused of praising unrealistic goals. The TTC has a new campaign with the National Ballet of Canada. It's called We Move You, and it's meant to showcase Toronto's art scene and how both move people, the TTC physically and the National Ballet emotionally. But Body Confidence Canada said that the ads promote unhealthy body stereotypes. The TTC said that in the past they've partnered with the Raptors and Toronto FC, and those ads also featured athletic body types, but body issues never came up. Both organizations may have been challenged about the goals of their campaigns, but they certainly got people talking about it. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Madonna. Halloween is supposed to be a night of fun for children across the nation, but some kids only found danger. In Toronto, two cars collided in Don Mills, resulting in the injuries of three 13-year-old pedestrians. The three children were trick-or-treating at the time of the accident. Two of them, a boy and a girl who were twins, sustained serious injuries but are in stable condition. The other victim, a boy, only sustained minor injuries and was not brought to the hospital.
Some children found danger within their candy bags. In Ottawa, children were given chocolate bars with sewing needles in them, despite the wrapper seemingly not being tampered with. In Halifax, a 12-year-old boy cut his thumb and discovered a razor blade in his candy. Back in Milton, a mother found a mini rum bottle in her daughter's candy bag filled with unidentified clear substance. Police across the nation are urging parents to thoroughly check their children's candy bags.
You've been listening to News Night, your daily news show. I'm Natasha Herman.
And I'm Nikhil Sharma. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Current Affairs section of Newsnight. I'm Ashley Pooch. It's been an exciting week in sports with Toronto Raptors' DeMar DeRozan setting a new franchise record and Game 6 of the World Series taking place tonight. Later in the show, Bryce Turner will tell us all about it. We also take a close look at commuters who use cycling to get around the Toronto area and have a blast from the past with the rising popularity of the classic vinyl record. But first, we have a story about an important panel that was featured during Ryerson's Social Justice Week. Sexual assault and rape culture are prominent issues in need of solutions. Art is a form of social activism and a therapeutic means to spread a very clear message. Sydney McInnes reports on today's panel during Ryerson's 6th annual Social Justice Week.
As a part of Ryerson's annual Social Justice Week, 6 sexual violence survivors discussed the importance of art, specifically when dealing with trauma. The panel, titled Art Heals, Interventions in Addressing Sexual Violence, was led by Cassandra Myers, a student who works with the Ryerson Center for Women and Trans People. The panelists engaged in a vulnerable discussion, where they talked about what it means to be a female artist while exploring themes of violence against women that come from personal experience. These women aim to encourage others to turn to art specifically when looking for coping mechanisms, and they encourage this through their art. We talked to Mickey Agnelli and Emma Sodergren, two Ryerson social work students, about what they learned. Agnelli is passionate about social justice and art alike.
I also loved the pieces they used on art as healing, and not just from sexual violence, but from anything you're going through in your life, how healing art can be, and not in just the traditional forms of art, in any form of art you choose. And yeah, I'm feeling really inspired.
Sodergren talked about how she'll go forward with her art after today.
I really agreed with what they're saying, that there's like this notion of what art is, and like if you're not very legitimate or you don't see yourself as legitimate, you kind of like devalue your art. But I think they really opened up my eyes and being like okay with being okay with what I do and not having to set like this standard for it by other people.
The panelists individually explore breaking down rape culture through dance, storytelling, illustration, and film. After the panel wrapped up, a 15-minute short film titled Ineffable was played. Directed by Paige Foskett, one of the panelists, the film explores an individual woman's experience with sexual violence through the vehicle of performance art and dance. This is Sydney McInnes reporting for Newsnight.
Since 1995, the Toronto Debating Society has got together to argue amongst themselves. They've discussed topics including whether vaccinations should be mandatory, if unpaid internships should be illegal, and if public transit in Toronto should be free. And last week, they put a comedic spin on a topic that could not be more serious, the front runners in the U.S. presidential election. Ryan Tusho has this story.
I'm guessing you are. I am. And there's like a
Welcome. Tonight at the Toronto Debating Society, it is October 25th, 2016. This is a comedy debate. Our resolution is Hillary Clinton is more trustworthy than Donald Trump.
At Swansea Town Hall near Runnymede and Bloor, where the Toronto Debate Society meets every other Tuesday from September to May, David Furlong acts as the Prime Minister for this debate.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. We will offer two arguments.
The organization allows members to volunteer for different positions every week. Two members serve as the government, who in this case support the position that Hillary Clinton is more trustworthy than Donald Trump. Two members serve as the opposition.
Now next, the Leader of the Opposition will speak to us for 7 minutes. Please help me welcome Michael.
Both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition are given 7 minutes to speak. Once both leaders speak, their seconds have an opportunity to speak for 5 minutes each.
A lifetime in public service qualifies one to be looked upon as trustworthy. I remind the government that Richard Nixon, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler were also...
The nonprofit organization was founded in 1995 as the Swansea Debating and Public Speaking Society. In 2001, the membership of the club was dwindling and its activities were suspended. But once vigorous attempts were made to increase membership, the club was renamed the Toronto Debating Society.
He hates overweight women. You can trust that he's never met a woman he didn't grow.
Once both sides have delivered their arguments, whoever serves as adjudicator judges the performance of both sides and announces the winning team, as well as the best debater. For this debate, Dean Girard offered commentary on the debate.
So, not particularly strong in the summations, and in the end, I awarded the debate to the opposition.
The night isn't over yet. After the debate, the group meets at the Dark Horse pub a few blocks away for a chance to catch up and chat about the debate. This is where I got the chance to speak to a few of the members about how they got into debating and what this organization means to them.
My name is David Furlong and I've been a member now for 10 years.
You know, my partner tonight was debating for the first time and she joined 2 weeks ago and that was exactly my experience 10 years ago. I came along one night and the next meeting 2 weeks later I was debating. Well, I'm a Newfoundlander so we like argument, like the repartee, the give and take, you know, the chance for humor. You know, and as one of our members remarked a few years ago, I'll never forget it. He said, it's the only place that I get a chance to have the last word. I certainly don't get it at home.
My name is Dean Girard, and I've been a member of the Toronto Debating Society for 19 years. When I joined in 1997, I just moved to the city from Peterborough, and I found out about the club through a notice in the Toronto Star.
Next week, the Toronto Debating Society will be hosting an unscripted debate, which is where participants are not allowed any research on the topic of whether guaranteed annual income is a waste of money.
And I thought, okay. I had just come from a Toastmasters group in Peterborough, where I'd been there for 4 years, and I thought, okay, let's go beyond just public speaking, and we'll try debating.
And we have the best humor.
There's an annual $75 fee to become a member, which covers the cost of using the second floor council chamber in the Swansea Town Hall. Guests who cannot participate in the actual debates are always free to attend meetings and offer their commentary and thoughts before and after the debates.
Of the debate because of the humorous part.
It was a fair and honest forum. With a lot of camaraderie, a lot of rhetoric, a lot of humor, and just wonderful times afterwards. Yeah. It's everything that I wanted it to be and more.
The organization creates educational videos that include tips on how to speak in public and best practices for successful debating. Dean Girard calls this part of the group's public service. These videos, as well as past debates, can be found on their YouTube channel, Toronto Debating. For more information, you can visit their website, torontodebating.com. In Toronto, I'm Ryan Tuchel.
You can wipe the dust off your record player because vinyl is coming back. The days of shutting out the world with your headphones are quickly being replaced by the old ways of vinyl. Now, listeners can go back in time and listen to music while engaging with those around them. Noella Ovid has this story.
The tables have turned. Vinyl, which used to be an outdated piece of plastic, is making its comeback. CD and digital sales have gone down since the arrival of online streaming services. Meanwhile, vinyl record sales continue to skyrocket. In the past, vinyl provided listeners with a unique social experience. According to Eric Schwab, manager of digitization, preservation, and arts at the Toronto Reference Library.
It was just more immersive than putting on singular headphones and only you can hear it. It's more inspired or more creative in the sense that you have to search for each record physically and sort of make a playlist in your head.
The Toronto Reference Library is using vinyl to bring users back.
Well, we're not just a place where people go to ask questions anymore, so sort of jumping onto that bandwagon of vinyl records, it's a good way to us to connect with the younger community, and because our goal is to have people come back to the library.
The library carries a massive vinyl record collection. Schwab manages its collection of 15,000 records.
So you can see they're just in numeric order.
They carry a unique collection of records, such as one by a band named Toronto and a compilation of songs by Subway musicians.
So let's pull, this is a band called Toronto. I've never heard it, but 1508, classic. There's a record of Toronto subway musicians.
Kids are waking up in the morning, hurrying down to the subway, playing an hour, having breakfast.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
Schwab says that holding a physical copy of music as opposed to listening to it digitally makes a huge difference.
I think the younger generation is really interested in having something they can hold on to.
Jack Leeper is a university student who's been listening to records since he was 12.
You know, always picked up cool vinyl along the way. It's pretty neat. I think like holding a physical piece of music is always like, I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting movement. Like, you can listen as much as you want on Spotify or Apple Music and whatnot, but like just always holding it and playing it, it's a different experience.
Today, he's at Kensington Market.
We're just shopping, having a good time in Kensington today, looking at some Japanese art and vinyl. I always come to this place, I find it really interesting, so brought a few friends by.
The owner of the store, Gray Coyote, is a vinyl enthusiast. He says that vinyl sound quality is beyond compare.
They got the technology to a point in every step of the process, starting with the studio, the acoustics of the studio, the engineering gear, the arrangement of the players and the microphones and the tape that was being used, and then, you know, the cutting process and the pressing process and the quality of the vinyl itself. They got it to such a level of near perfection that it became really quite wonderful, and I'll give you an example of that right now. This is Sinatra.
According to Coyote, people have too much information being thrown at them these days. Listening to records gives them a chance to take a step back.
Hey, in a world, you know, where there's so much crazy, maybe it's nice to slow down, think about the whole side of a record you'd like to listen to instead of maybe listening to all of one song before your thumbs are going again to get the next song, or your friend is saying, no, let me show you this one. And why don't you just slow down, shut up, pour a drink, and listen to the whole side of a good record. It's a way when you're at home to take it down a few notches.
Unlike digital music, which is easily shared through song files, vinyl records can only physically belong to one person at a time. They can be passed down from generation to generation or seller to reseller, but they cannot be duplicated. Coyote is passing down his personal record collection to his daughter, Kaya.
And there's a little note to my daughter, who's 5. I leave little notes on a lot of my records to her, so when I kick off and die, I'll still be talking to her.
One record that he especially wants her to hear is by Paul McCartney. It
says, Kaya, this one. Now, what do I mean by that?
Distractions. We got married, put it there, figuratively, this one. Oh, this one. You want her to listen to this one.
Right. This one, this one. It was one of his last hits, and it's a beautiful song about being in the moment of love. This one. Play a little guitar.
With vinyl's comeback, it might be a good idea to invest in a record player or even borrow your grandparents. For Newsnight, I'm Noella Ovid.
People who live in the Toronto area take 14 million trips every day, but I was surprised to hear that only 6% of these trips are either walked or cycled. Ryerson professor Dr. Raktim Mitra has completed a study about these cycling behaviors and how to improve them. The study has received funding from Metrolinx and is a collaboration between Ryerson's Transform Laboratory and the Toronto Centre for Active Transportation. I spoke to Dr. Mitra today about the report, specifically about the gender gaps surrounding the issue of cycling as transportation. Okay, so we're talking to you today about your study that you completed. Do you want to tell me a little bit about it?
Well, North American regions and municipalities are trying to improve cycling rates. And we have seen a lot of new policies that focuses on this issue. And this policy emphasis is supported by strong grassroots advocacy and to some extent popular interest on the topic of cycling. However, if we look at the rates of cycling as it exists today, it's very low. Only about 1% of all trips in the GTHA, for example, is being biked now. So in this study, what we wanted to look at is to see whether cycling is or it should be an important policy issue. In other words, we wanted to quantify the untapped potentials for cycling, identify trips that could be cycled under favorable conditions and by people who would want to bike.
Okay, and your study finds that only 30% of the current cyclists in the GTHA are women. How do you figure women are the way forward for this?
If we look at, like you mentioned, if we look at the cyclists on the streets now, only about a third of them are female, and the rate goes even lower if we look at suburban communities outside of downtown Toronto. However, if we look at the trips that we are making on a day-to-day basis, women are actually making more trips that are shorter and that could, according to our definition, potentially be cycled. So from a policy perspective, if our planners and engineers are interested in improving the rates of biking at a population level, targeting women seems like a more an easier way to do so, because they are making more trips that could be cycled, and at the same time, fewer women are biking on the streets as of now.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have to talk about this.
Okay.
But is there anywhere anyone can get more information if they're interested on this topic?
Well, our report is posted online on our website, transformlab@ryerson.ca. So anyone can go and download the report. And
all right, perfect.
Okay.
Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Still on the cycling beat, Justin Chandler spoke with Claire McFarlane, a Ryerson student who co-founded a club to make women and trans people more comfortable cycling.
Cycling has grown in popularity in downtown Toronto, but people still aren't cycling as much as they could, according to a Ryerson report released in October. The report on cycling potential in the GTHA found that although nearly one-third of the 14 million trips GTHA residents take daily could be cycled, just 1% are. The report notes a lot of room for cycling growth among women, who make 8% more cyclable trips than men, but make up just 30% of the city's cyclists. Claire McFarlane is a fourth-year journalism student and co-founder of the Bad Girls Bike Club.
Because the industry is so traditionally male-dominated, we sort of wanted to create our own space that's safe for women and trans people. One of the reasons that we decided to start the group was that we were hearing from both men and women that they feel intimidated by the idea of riding downtown, so we sort of just wanted to show them that it's really not that bad, it's totally doable, and it's a lot of fun. I ride my bike everywhere. I live like 5 minutes from campus and I still ride my bike because it's a faster, it's like a 2 minute ride. So I ride here, I ride to work, I ride for fun when I'm going out too, so yeah.
McFarlane says that for a lot of the cyclists she speaks to, their biggest fears are getting hit by cars or caught in streetcar tracks. Her advice?
Doing shoulder checks before you sort of move into another lane is always good. Some people forget to kind of like look before they turn. Facing streetcar tracks at a 90 degree angle is much better than trying to sort of weave in between them. That's how a lot of people get stuck. And other than that, just being aware of your surroundings. Try not to use earbuds when you're riding, although some of us do it sometimes. But try to avoid that and just to be as aware as possible.
Watch it.
But sometimes even frequent cyclists run into problems. Take city councillor for Ward 27, Kristen Wong Tam.
I have been doored personally, and I have had at least two car accidents, which involved a car hitting me on two separate occasions during my time of riding a bicycle in Toronto.
Nancy Smith Lee, a principal investigator on the Ryerson Cycling Report, has also been doored.
It really hurts. Yeah, it's very sudden, and it's despite all of the ways that we're instructed to navigate the city to avoid it, it's really difficult to avoid.
Although McFarlane says most of her cycling experiences have been positive, she's had her share of negative ones as well.
Yeah, we had, this is a really sad story, but someone who came out with us to ride, and she had ridden like twice before in the city. And the second time she ended up getting doored. Someone opened up the door on her and she fell and sort of scraped herself up. And that was kind of a bummer. And then when she was riding with us, we were riding in a protected bike lane and a cab was sitting in the bike lane. So we had to go around. And then as she was trying to get back up into the bike lane, she ended up falling. And it was really very sad. But she was fine. she was just seemed to think it was part of the experience. So.
Smith Lee and her team think that the best way to get more women riding bikes is to build more infrastructure in the city so people can cycle safely. Their study says women are less likely than men to cycle on unsafe streets. Councillor Wong Tam says that unless Toronto gets more cycling infrastructure, it's going to become more and more difficult to move people around. She says Toronto needs more bike lanes, bike parking, and bike share stations. Ian Cantello, one of the researchers who worked on the Ryerson report, thinks politics holds back the development of those things.
But just the idea of people saying that, okay, well, one lane less because we have a bike lane instead of, you know, cars going there, that's a huge problem, and that you can win votes based on that. It's something that I don't see really happening that often in the political discourse of the other cities that I've lived in this area. It's more, bike lanes are a public good. We should build bike lanes. That's it.
McFarlane agrees.
It's a lot more fun to be able to, as you're riding your bike, see the city, essentially, interact with your surroundings and being able to get some exercise while you're doing it. Once you get to where you're going, you're like full of endorphins and just generally a lot happier than you would be if you took the subway.
For Ryerson News Night, this is Justin Chandler.
It's a big day in the sports world today, with two of the youngest NHL superstars facing off in Toronto, and the possibility of a World Series win for Cleveland. Bryce Turner has this and more sports news.
Thanks, Ashley. Six athletes are being inducted into Canada's Sports Hall of Fame today. One of those athletes is Toronto Argonauts legend Mike Pinball Clemens.
In my game, there are 12 people on the field, right? And I'm one of them, right? And so there's 12 times more energy than me that's happening on that field. And so I didn't run a single yard by myself. They say I ran for more yards than anybody in pro football history. Not one was by myself. And so this, for me, is a chance to thank those who worked so diligently for me.
Other inductees include Stanley Cup winner Brian Trottier and curling champion Colleen Jones. In the NHL, the number one draft picks from the last two seasons will face off tonight. The Toronto Maple Leafs will host the Edmonton Oilers at 7:30. The Leafs' Austin Matthews went first overall in the draft last June, while the Oilers' Connor McDavid was the top pick last season. Edmonton is off to a strong start with 7 wins in 9 games. In contrast, Toronto has only 2 wins in 9 games. DeMar DeRozan set a franchise record in last night's Raptors victory. The Toronto Raptors beat the Denver Nuggets 105-102. DeRozan scored 33 points in the game. He is the first player in franchise history to start a season with 3 30-plus games. The Raptors have won 2 of those 3 matchups. The next game is on the road tomorrow against the Washington Wizards. The Cleveland Indians enter Game 6 of the World Series with a chance to clinch the title. The Indians lead the Chicago Cubs 3-2 in baseball's championship series. A win tonight would bring Cleveland their first MLB championship since 1948. Jake Arrieta is the starting pitcher for Chicago, Josh Tomlin for Cleveland. Game 6 will take place tonight at 8 o'clock in Cleveland. A Texas golf range is ready for next week's U.S. presidential election. Photos of the candidates are displayed as targets. The photos, hung on round hay bales, show Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump with their mouths wide open. It is not clear if the golf balls are for or against each candidate. The number of golf balls around Clinton's hay bale shows that more people have teed off in her direction. The facility's owner calls it a touch of fun in this stressful election. And that's it for sports. Ashley, back to you.
Thanks, Bryce. That finishes off this week's edition of Newsnight. Thanks to this week's news anchors, Natasha and Nikhil. Join us next Tuesday for what I'm sure will be an exciting show as the U.S. presidential election comes to a close. See you then.